Morning. Thanks, Ann. Thanks very much. I enjoyed the dinner, especially your cake. I ate her cake, was it? I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. A member of the Big Book Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. I'm an alcoholic of the John type. That boy is really an alcoholic. You listen to those projections about the growth of this conference, ain't no doubt about his tendencies. Really great to be here. Folks don't understand what a price you have to pay to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly if you're going to get out and do any talking. That here we have to slave away in West Palm Beach, Florida. And isn't that brutal? I've been telling my wife what hard work this is. If she ever finds out what fun it is, God knows, she won't even let me go if I don't take her. I really am glad to be here. It's been just a delight. I want to congratulate you on the growth of the conference. It would have really been phenomenal if you could have found a way to get the dancers to be AAers and counted them. Sometimes we think self-support means what the group sends rather than what I send. I really am pleased to be. It's been a great weekend. Got off to a great start. The reception at the airport was... My God, I thought I was a member of the Miami Dolphins or something when I came in, and that cheerleader squad there with balloons and girls in miniskirts and guys unfortunately in shorts that look bad. We got off to a good start. It is great to be down. I've got to tell you one thing about the air thing. This didn't work right somehow. I go a lot, and I don't really pay attention to where I'm going until I get ready to go. And I got the agent takes care of that stuff, and she just tells me where I'm going and when. And so I got the tickets. Jan had called me wanting to know when I was coming in, and I called her when I got the tickets and said, "Be in at 3:45 at Miami." And she, you know what a pregnant, what a pregnant pause is? They want to remind you, it's uncomfortable, I've been told. I heard this thunderous silence, and I said, uh-oh, apparently Miami is not place of choice. She didn't say anything else, and I said I'll have somebody over there, and I said, uh-oh, I better do something heroic. So I got scrambling around and worked it out to get moved up to West Palm. No complaints from anybody so far. And so I wanted to call, and it's, you know, when folks are scurrying around trying to get a convention, it's hard to find them. And I finally got John on the phone to let him know that didn't want search parties in both airports. And then I tried to call Jan. And apparently I'm not a good bookkeeper, because I pulled out a slip of paper. I keep a little file on there where I'm going. And I pulled out a little piece of paper, had Joan. I said, well, that's close enough. She probably hadn't been sober long, didn't quite know what her name is yet. And so I called, and a nice man answered the phone, and I said, is Joan there? And he said, no. I said, has she already gone to the airport? He said, no, not really. I don't think she's at work. And I said, well, can you get word to her? I don't want to make her to make an unnecessary trip to the airport, because I'm not going to Miami. Another pregnant pause. And he said, Tom, you understand Joan is the chairman of the Arkansas Summer Conference? So being a quick-witted alcoholic, I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll call you back and see if I can't get a little closer than Miami. Then I did the heroic thing for an alcoholic. I said, man, I'm wrong. It's two left feet. Heck, I got the wrong month, wrong state. Thank God, right drunk. And so here we are. And I tell you, it's been something else. It's been uphill from that point on. And it really has been neat. I got to quit messing around. I did a two-taper on Bob a while back. I ain't going to do that today now. I promise you that. I swear, I never have been listed on a program where it started at 9:30. It closed at 12. Dang, now you do that to a drunk, he's going to just have an instinct to fill in the void in there somewhere. But I'll trust there's something else going on and quit. You know, what I want to do is just basically what we all do. I want to share one drunk story. I think more particularly, I'd really like to share with a notice that I was one of the older rats in the barn. Dangerous putting old-timers on last. Hell, we may not live to be here for the meeting when you're this old. That I want to share with you some good news, really. There's some heartbreak in any AA story, but there's some awfully good news. And I'm a fellow that is genuinely blessed, fellow genuinely fortunate, deeply grateful for what my experience has been. I'm one of those who was fortunate enough to come in here and catch that elusive brass ring and have been sober since day one. And I personally think that's the very best way to do it. I know that there is enormous pain and suffering and considerable courage in folks who don't do it that way and go out and come back. But I don't recommend that. I really recommend this way. It's the finest way I know, and it can be done. Some folks think that that's a rare thing. I was sitting in a big book room in my home group a while back, and the first time I've ever seen it, every person in that room had been sober since their first meeting. So it's not as rare. Sometimes with some sort of a show of modesty, we don't talk about that much, but I think that's an awfully important message, that it's possible to catch this thing and hold on and ride it into a brand new way of living, new and different from anything I've ever known. That's been my experience, and I'm tremendously grateful for that. And I want to share with you a bit about it. Not only have I been able to stay sober, but I've been blessed with being able to be an enthusiastic, highly involved member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since I've been here. I was telling Jan, I believe, that you have some folks say that you go through a period when there's a pink cloud and you have just an intoxication with sobriety, but that it ends, and it does. It surely does. The minute you quit doing the things that put you there, it ends. But it doesn't have to. And it's possible to be an excited and dynamically involved member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's basically what I want to get at. So let me get at it. I'm an alcoholic. Our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. What I used to be like, I was a guy who drank a bunch. I loved booze. I liked booze the first time I ever drank. I was one of those for whom it did something remarkable the first time I drank, and practically every time I drank. It was a great solution for me. It was the key to comfortable living for me. It was the key to being a member of the human race, to being a functioning character in this thing called life. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. I thought for a long time when I first came into the program that I might have been born alcoholic. Because to the best of my knowledge, I've never had anything that could be genuinely described as a social drink. There is such a thing. I see people drink with relative impunity, and I know that is social drinking for whatever purpose. They just take a little drink and then ignore it. And I swear to God, it baffles me why they even bother. I've never done that in my life. I don't know the feeling of having a drink and having a sense of sufficiency. I don't remember ever in my life turning down a drink. If I did, I didn't understand the question if somebody asked you. I don't think I've ever turned one down. I was the kind of guy, I've heard some folks say they wouldn't take a drink if they couldn't get but one. My God, I was the kind of guy that would walk all the way across Miami on the rumor of a drink. My God, ain't much of a drunk to me that'll turn down a drink. I wasn't that kind of guy. I never had a social drink. I was always somebody for whom alcohol was extremely important. It did something valuable for me. And what happened to me? I wasn't born alcoholic. I was a kind of a disorganized kid that was having a lot of difficulty in the business of living. And booze solved that for me, and I just fell in love with it. I just fell in love. There's no mystery to that. I got caught up in it. I loved the way of life. I loved the people who drank. I thought they were exciting people. I still do think they're exciting people. They're totally unpredictable people. You never know what they're going to do. I enjoy being around folks who drink for a while. Till I hear the same joke the third time, louder and louder, and then I know it's time for me to go. But there is an air of excitement about the, I go out to Las Vegas and Reno at the old stomping ground, and I swear to God, I'm not there long before the pulse starts quickening you, and I get caught up in that climate. I love it. I still love jazz. I just listen to it in different places than I used to. So I got caught up in that thing. It was no real disease, no real complication to it. I was just somebody who fell in love with a way of life and took off. And my story was basically just like a runaway train. I was a guy that got caught up in it and never really questioned seriously what was happening until it was too late. Yeah, I read something one time that describes it to me in a way. It says the chains of habits go on so gently that we don't feel them till they're too strong to break. And in a way, the mind was not a gentle process, but the chains of alcoholism took me over so gently that I didn't realize it until way too late. And that's what happened. I somewhere in the process of becoming alcoholic, I crossed the line and I lost any semblance of ability to control my drinking. Now, as far as my behavior, as what I looked like, as what I was like when I drank, there probably was not any discernible difference as I went from one phase to another. I got as drunk as I could get the first time I drank, passed out, lay on the floor. That's about as good as you can do. And did about the same thing the last time I drank. Wasn't a heck of a lot of quality in the thing. I just sort of did that. And so you couldn't see a difference. But what happened was something happened differently on the inside. And I developed the disease alcoholism. And I'm one who believes that alcoholism is a disease. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more a little later on, I think. But suffice it to say that it happened, and I became one of those people who simply could not handle booze in the sense that if I took a drink, I couldn't predict my behavior. I was typically the kind of guy that would stop by the place, whatever my favorite haunt was at the moment, I'd stop by the place to have a couple of beers with the guys and wind up closing the joint. Going to a bootleg joint in jail, waking up my car, whatever. That was typical of me. Didn't plan it to be that way. I was just the kind of guy that simply could not predict what would happen if I took a drink. Now, I didn't give that much thought. I just thought I was a reckless fellow without a lot of self-control. I thought I was an undisciplined guy who was irresponsible and a little lacking in character. I'd wake up in the wrong state sometimes and say, Jesus, this is not quite right. And question it a little, but not much. Yeah, I'd just go on with the business. I knew that that wasn't exactly normal behavior, but I was the kind of guy who kept thinking that one day my ship will come in. One day I'll be able to get off on the right foot. One day I'll get it all together and this will all be behind me. Never seriously believed that I was an alcoholic. You know, to demonstrate what I was like and to move on, let me just share the two extremes of it. To the bright-eyed fella, 16 years old, bounced out of Belmont High School in North Carolina, full of optimism and hope like any kid coming out of high school. No earthly idea where my life would go, but I knew it was going to be okay. And then all I have to do is compare him to the fella who 8 short years later was living on the streets in the city of Flint, Michigan. Not a proud station in life. My buddy Sam knows about Flint, Michigan, and not a great station in life. That's where I wound up. I went up there chasing the fast buck and wound up with my reputation getting in front of me and wound up unemployed and unemployable in a town that would hire anything that breathed. The last job that I had that was, yeah, I call it a quasi-legal job, it was somewhat legal. We had a license to do some of the stuff. I managed a black and tan club in a section of Flint that I never believed I'd wind up in. God knows. It was quasi-legal. We did have a license to do some of it, but God knows I sold everything that a human would buy, including other people. It wasn't exactly an aristocratic Southern gentleman's goal in life. I was the drunkest guy in the place. Hell, I had to be. I couldn't stand to be in that kind of a setting with that. And then I wound up fired, of course. And then wound up just basically surviving the way we can survive. I used to say that I lived by my wits, but that's not exactly true. That's a little euphemistic. What I did was survive by my lack of character. I don't know of anything. You know, you look at me today and I'm a fairly clean-looking fella. I'm not proud of it by any stretch of the imagination, but in the last year that I drank, I did survive by my lack of character. I don't know of anything that a man can do that I haven't done. None. Now, I'm not proud of it by any stretch of the imagination. You can hurry up and believe. I'm deeply ashamed of that. But I pray to my God that I never get so removed from my alcoholism so arrogant in my recovery that I forget where I came from or that I'm unwilling to share, because that's the power of the story. And I never want to forget that my alcoholism was not just some cute little overdone party. My alcoholism was a killer disease. And have absolutely no doubt that I would have drunk myself to death at an early age if I hadn't been brought to a stop. And many of you are well aware that I wasn't brought to a stop quickly enough, because I wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room has feared doing, every family member even more, I'm sure. I've never met an alcoholic who hadn't gone through some rather difficult fears about hurting somebody else, and thank God most don't. Most alcoholics are decent people. We hide it well, but deep down, most of us are fairly decent people, don't want to hurt folks. And I was no different. I knew that I was capable of anything, but I never really believed that the kinds of stuff that you fear most would ever happen. One morning I woke up in jail in Flint. There was no novelty to that. God knows how many times I'd been in jail. I have no earthly idea. Apparently exactly enough times, because I haven't been since I got sober. And so apparently it was just enough to keep me here once I got here. So I'm grateful for every one of them. That I woke up in jail this morning, didn't know why I was there, assumed it was for the same as always, either drunk or hustling or fighting or whatever. And the jailer came by after I was awake a while, and I knew him, knew everybody in there, and I said, when could I get out? He said, I hope never, and walked off. I didn't know what he was talking about. And then some of the other guys in there told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, and it run over and killed two people. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that you think about but you can't comprehend. You know, and my reaction was just simply to push it away, to block it out. Couldn't deal with it, and then gradually accepted the truth. Knew I would never take another drink. Knew that. I didn't think I could pick up another drink. The guilt was too great. Released on bond after 76 days, stayed sober day and a half, and then, of course, I drank. Like nobody I've ever seen, between July and November of 1956, I drank like nobody I've ever seen. No question what I was trying to do. Obviously trying to drink myself to death. Just as obviously that didn't happen. And then November the 19th of 56, I went to court to be tried on the charge of manslaughter. And there was no mystery about that either. I had no defense. My plea was to stand mute, because I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me what I'd done. And I was, of course, found guilty and sentenced to a max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I was a street character, and I'd been in jail innumerable times, but that's a different deal. You know, Jackson Prison is not Disneyland, I'll assure you of that. I've probably been to half the penitentiaries in this country, and I don't know if you rate those suckers, but I would rate that one the second or third worst one in the United States. The day I walked in, there were 6,000 people, to use the term loosely, in there. So it really were some fine people, some of the finest guys I've ever known in my life, and some of the sorest excuses for human beings that I've ever seen. Liberal mix of both. And so I had no illusions about what that meant. You know, that was not an overnight flop or a stockade or a pea farm. That was a different deal. And so my instinctive reaction was one of fear. Natural reaction. God, anybody's would be. But almost simultaneously, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was done. It was over. Not hope, but resignation. I just knew it was done. And the next day I was let off on a chain, literally a chain, with five other guys. Walked into Jackson. Absolutely resigned to my fate. I never believed I would ever come out of there alive, and truly did not care. I didn't really want to come out. I just wanted to be gone. To be gone. Mighty sick young fellow. Didn't really understand how sick I was, so I started to get well. And then the chain of events that led to my being here today started happening. I really was an out-of-it guy. I didn't speak to anybody there. They put me in a cell. I sat there, didn't engage in conversation, didn't ask anybody where they were from or care. I just sat there, read anything I could do to keep from thinking. One day, a guy, a little social worker, called me out for an interview. And it was a routine thing. I'd been interviewed by lots of people. I'd been diagnosed by lots of people. Never had one diagnosis in my life. You're an alcoholic, or my God, you drink a lot, or you're sure goofy when you drink. That's all I'd ever heard. And this guy was no different. He looked at my record and he said, "My gosh, you've drunk a lot." And then he said something that I'd never heard before. He said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you better go." Exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an invitation or an order, just a flat declarative statement. We have an AA group, think you better go. I had never heard of AA. Now, we weren't a deep, dark secret in 1956 and 57. There were 100 and some thousand of us. But I'd never heard of it. They didn't talk about it in my circles. That's for doggone sure. And so it was a whole brand new phenomenon to me. I'd never even heard of anybody helping a drunk. That whole concept was foreign to me. And so I don't remember if we had any more conversation or not. I just listened to him. A few days later, I got a little piece of paper in the mail, Ivester, 94153-3938. That's my whole identity. That was my name, rank, serial number, and address. And it said, "Report your first meeting, it didn't say Groundhog Day, but that's what it was, February 2nd, 1957. Didn't particularly want to go. I think the only reason I went was that, you ever been to the place that you just didn't have any fight left? That you were just beat? That was it. I couldn't muster an argument. I just walked over. I had no earthly idea what it would be like, and walked in and sat down to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened? You know, our stories reveal what we were like. What happened? You know, what is it that happens to a young fellow, 24 years old, walking into an alien way of life that he knows nothing about, trying to revive a life that he just wished were over? What is it that cuts through and really makes a difference in that kind of a thing? I don't know if I can capture that or not, but there has to be something awfully powerful to intervene and provide a real solution that lasts for many, many years, and I hope going to last many, many more. So what happened? I can only report to you what went on. The guy that spoke at that first meeting, wonderful fellow. His name was Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good friend of Sam. He was the first speaker that I'd ever heard. I hadn't listened to many of any kind, but this guy was the first AA speaker I ever heard. And he did basically what I'm doing this morning. He just did it in a kind of a different way, but he told his story. I'd never heard a drunk tell anything like that. I'd heard drunks tell stories, all kinds, God knows. Fighting stories, women's stories, and on and on. This guy told his story. It had to be true. Nobody gonna make that up. My God. That guy was a pure... It just shocked me, really. The truth was shocking to me, I guess. If anybody had asked me after that meeting what it was like, I would have probably said something like, "You wouldn't believe it." Because I had absolutely no connection to that. The way I lived on the street, the brother's keeper philosophy didn't prevail. And this business of it helps me to help you, that would have been music to my ears before I got there. And so I didn't understand any of that human kindness business that he just told that story. And the thing that marvels me about that to this day is that I went back. I didn't have to, obviously. I could have sat in my cell and stared at my navel or whatever I wanted to do. But I went back. Never missed a meeting. I stayed in that place 42 months before they released me and sent me back to North Carolina. Never missed a meeting. Now, you can hurry up and believe, for a good while, it wasn't because I had fallen in love with the program, believed I was an alcoholic, wanted to be sober the rest of my life, any of that. I was just a face in the crowd. I was like a cow in a herd, just sort of moving with the group, and it didn't really mean that much for a good while. I really think the one thing that brought me back to the second meeting was the magical enthusiasm of Shy Walker. I didn't identify with him. He was as different from me as anybody had ever seen. He was a short fellow, very crude fellow in a lot of ways. He was an uneducated guy. He never learned to pronounce Alcoholics Anonymous. He was sober till the day he died, and he never learned to pronounce this program. In fact, he sponsored a speech therapist one time and tried to get him to teach. He just couldn't say it, but he lived it better than anybody I've ever seen. And the power of that enthusiasm that just exploded out of that guy, I think, was what brought me back for a good while to Alcoholics Anonymous. Certainly not because of any real important thing going on with me. And when I think about what happened, what was it that cut through to that fellow sitting under a mountain of guilt ashamed to even be in a place where folks were talking about hope and help, ashamed to be breathing. What is it that cuts through? Yeah, I would submit two things to you that are pretty fundamental to me. One was the fact that I went into an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The recovery group at Jackson Prison at that time was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous, as good as any I've ever seen. Unfortunately, it's not in that condition now. I was back up in July, and it was I'm thankful that I didn't go into a group like it is today. But I went into a fine group of Alcoholics Anonymous, one that knew how to treat newcomers, one that introduced me in a no-nonsense kind of way to the program, not by learned road scholars, but by other guys, other alcoholics who were inmates in that prison who experienced something and they shared it with others. A good, solid, fundamental introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous that served me well about the fact that there really is a program here. This is not some mystical event. There really is a design for living here. That was important. The other thing that I think may be even more important when you get down to it, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous is not a technology. That it's not a learned behavior type of thing. It's a way of life. It's a spirit. And I think the thing that may be even more important were the guys like Shy who walked into my life. Yeah, you know, when I think back to what made a difference with me, I remember guys like Shy and that absolute bounce of life that guy conveyed everywhere he went. I remember a little Mexican fellow by the name of Gene Salazar. He used to drive all the way from Chicago to come up and carry the message. And, you know, all these guys are dead now, but not with me. Old Gene would come in, and he called himself the All-American Irish Wetback. He had come over here, and he married some big old Irish girl, and he would talk about his life, talk about the fights, and God knows I could just vicariously participate in that life of his. What a great fellow. He always made a profound thing. He always closed his talk with a thing that, funny how some things stick in your mind. He would always say, every man comes equipped with two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. Your success in life largely depends on which end you use. Heads you win and tails you lose. That's you may want to write that down, words to live by. Yeah, but I remember that. Yeah. And oh my God, so many guys who walked in and marvelously shared what their lives were about. Cuts through and gives hope. There is nothing that so effectively reaches an alcoholic as another alcoholic sharing his life. You know, some people think that in order to get through to guys in a joint, that you've got to have had some real checkered career and you've got to be some kind of a thug, a bank robber. Not so. Yeah, I appreciated everybody who ever walked into that prison. The closest I ever came to not appreciating somebody were the folks who came in and had some stereotypical image in their mind of what a convict was and would reflect in what they had to say and to use the vilest gutter language they could possibly come up with. Quote, talking their language. Closest I came to not appreciating anybody was folks who, you know, what they were talking showed what they considered me. The first person that ever got through to me in a way that I identified, I'd been sober in the group about 2 years and had not identified with a single member, not a single alcoholic, not really, not deep down. And then one day somebody, I believe they conned this guy. He was a furniture salesman from Detroit named Lewis. And I think they had told him they were going to a picnic or something. And he got in the car innocently and found himself in Jackson Prison. Scariest man I've ever seen in my life. And then they even made him talk. And the poor fellow got up, great big guy, got up, and he was so scared he spoke in a falsetto. You know, his voice just squeaked. And by golly, it clicked. I finally heard an alcoholic. I didn't identify with a falsetto particularly, but this guy talked about how he felt. You know, he talked about what was going on. Man, he was too scared to be cute. He was just flat telling it like it was. And my God, he never came back. He never came back. He didn't have that much nerve. But thank God he came one time. He came one time and I identified. Well, you know, you see what I'm talking about. You know, one thing is the fundamental design of a program. But the other thing that's a big part of what happened are the people who really bring that message in, the people who really give the hope. And that's the heart and soul of our College Dominion. This conference may grow bigger than International Johnson, but no conference we ever have will get 1 ounce taller, one iota bigger, 1 centimeter nobler than one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Don't care how big it gets. That's the heart. That whole business. You know, there's a lot more to. Bob, you yell at me now if I even get close to anything. But there's more to this thing. Now, I don't want to preach, but when you talk about what happened, yeah, I think there's a lot to what happens. Yeah, and folks don't just get into solid recovery and become happy, joyous, and free just because they get inspired or regimented in some solid thinking. There's a great deal more than just that. You know, when you think about the solution, what is it that causes? I've shared a little bit about what was effective with me. But you know, in getting emotionally washed with somebody else's love is like a warm bath. You know, it lasts as long as it lasts, then it's gone. But there's got to be something more. It has to really get into a little deeper context. And when I think about solution, and when I think about what it is that causes good, solid, healthy recovery, Clance talked about it a little bit last night. Yeah. By the way, Clance, I wish him all the best. He's in up near God this morning on United Airlines. He heard what he came to hear, and he told me he's gonna buy this tape and listen to it reverently for a week. Hey, Clance. Forgot where it was. But when you look at solution, you know, when you look at what's in the solution, there's an awful lot of things. And what he got at was about how the pain drives the recovery, and how true that is. You know, that, and when I think about where solid recovery, where real happiness and joyousness and freedom comes from, it comes from strange places. And let me just submit a couple of things that have been sort of fundamental to me in how this thing comes about. You know, one, I won't boggle you with anything new. Mine's so bedrock, you won't believe it. You won't find me talking about anything you won't find in the book. When you look at this, yeah, I think fundamental is this whole business about knowledgeably getting to a bottom. Now, that's not just an intellectual exercise. This business of recognizing at the core of my being that I am as low as I can go, that I have absolutely hit the bottom of alcoholism. I don't mean it's become inconvenient or disorderly or even painful, but that it has become an untenable way to live. That's why I'm thankful for every jail I was ever in. Apparently it was enough, because I have no illusions about what's there. You know, I hear some folks say that one of the great gifts they've been given in sobriety is a choice. Now, a book doesn't quite support that. Choice isn't really what this is about. Yeah, that's a willful kind of term. Yeah, and what our book refers to is that when it comes to alcohol, there is no choice. Yeah, for guys like me who have become genuine alcoholics, drinking is not an option. It simply is not an option. It's not a matter that I cognitively elect not to drink. It's a fact that for a guy like me, it is not an option. Our book refers to that a lot of ways. You know, it really interested me about how our book is written. Some people kind of get caught up in the waves and trends in the program that come along and go away. You know, we get caught up in the notion that, like, speaker meetings. You know, a lot of people say, I don't like speaker meetings. I don't like drunk-a-log. Let me just suggest one thing that, just to think about, in case you get drifting in that direction. when you take a look at the book, and I'm not a technician particularly of the book, but let me just suggest something to you about the book. When you look at the construct of the book, two-thirds of the book are drunkalogs. Two-thirds of it. That much. More than that. That much, yes. Are drunkalogs. Two-thirds of it. And when you look at the basic text, which describes in detail precisely how recovery happens, guess what? One-fourth of the 164 deal with the hopelessness of the disease. Oh, they tease us a bit with solution. But the ultimate message all the way is that for us, it has to be smashed. Any notion that we are like other people must be smashed. Bottom. An absolute awareness that when it comes to drinking, it's not an option. When it comes to drinking, I am not like other people just in form. I am somebody who has a deadly disease. Very important for me to know that. I believe that that's the painful springboard that Clancy was talking about last night that sets up real recovery. I personally think it's the key to the doorway called recovery. Because without it, the rest of this is just nice philosophy. This has to be born of desperate knowledge that I am sunk. And this is my way out. Bottom. You know, we sometimes glide away from that business, but awfully, awfully important. That's why it's so important to hear other alcoholics sharing their experience. Hear the pain of it. To hear what alcoholism looks and smells like. And say, by golly, I'm not the only person like this. Intellectual, frothy, emotional appeal, chatty discussions don't produce that. I don't believe. Bottom, I think, is an awfully important, valuable thing that we have to have. They may happen at a little more informed level than they did when I came in, but I personally don't think there's any shortcut. It still has to happen. But it's not enough, obviously, is it? All of us have hit bottom God knows how many times. Yeah, I believe that somewhere very close to the time, there's a critical element of timing in it. Maybe good fortune, I don't know what. Divine providence, call it what you will. But I think obviously bottom's not enough, and I really believe that somewhere very close to the point of bottom, something has to happen in which a solution becomes known to me. A solution becomes known. Now that's a kind of a nice flag-waving term. What are we talking about? What are we talking about? A solution has to become known. Yeah, I always find it a little easier to talk about what it ain't than what it is. You know, that I can make the point better for me to understand it with what it isn't. You know, and when I think about trying to get down to what the solution is, I have to eliminate some things, you know, that, you know, like this book, for example. That's not a solution. That's not a solution. This is a description of a solution. Yeah, it's a strange thing that's happened in our fellowship. We're about 2 million strong. We've sold about 12 or 13 million of these. I don't know who's got them. It must be the NAFTA treaty or something that's got it. Yeah, it's a strange thing that's happened with the book. We've almost deified it. And I don't mean any, please understand, I don't mean any disrespect to this. I'm a great believer in the utility of the book. I belong to a big book group. I'm in a big book meeting every week of my life. I just finished doing about a 10 or 11 month workshop with a bunch of folks who wanted to go through the book and deal with recovery. So I'm a great believer in the book. But I'm a great believer in keeping it in its proper context. And deified holiness ain't it. You know, the book is a marvelous thing. But it's a messenger. It captures the message. It describes the message, it's not the messenger. Yeah, we get into a thing where we almost make an intellectual pursuit out of it. We get into meetings and spend endless periods of time defining words and endlessly get into teaching and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just one who's a little bit leery of trying to teach what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. This is about sharing. It's not an intellectual activity, and the book simply describes and conveys that as a good way of making it consistent and reliable. So while I'm a great believer in it, yeah, I'm not one who believes that it's the magic bullet, that we have to keep it in its context. It's interesting to me that the book had minimal kind of emphasis when I came into the program. Minimal emphasis. Today it has far greater, 25 times greater emphasis than it did when I came in. You couldn't give a big book away when I came in. Now, my God, you sell them for $10,000. Strange thing. So it's not the book itself. And just giving somebody a book and saying, go read this, is a kind of a cruel way to pretend 12-step work. So if it ain't a book, what is it? How about meetings? Meetings. You know, you hear people talk about the magic of meetings. And meetings do have tremendous value, but they also have limitations. They have limitations. And what happens in meetings is an unpredictable thing. I was interviewing a fellow. I was doing a lot of work with a group at a penitentiary down in North Carolina, the Central Prison in Raleigh, the Maximum Custody Joint. And I was interviewing a guy. He didn't know I was in AA. I don't guess. I hadn't told him. And I was interviewing him, and he was telling me about himself. He didn't need to tell me much. God knows, you can look at his jacket. He's about like the guy that interviewed me. And I said, you ever had trouble with booze? He said, yeah, I had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, have you ever tried to do anything about it? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, have you ever been to treatment? No, I ain't never been to none of that. I said, well, have you ever gone to AA? Yes, sir, gone to AA. And I said, what'd you think? He said, biggest bunch of damn liars I ever saw in my life. Well, I was kind of interested in that. And I said, tell me about it. What makes you think so? He'd gone to one meeting. And he said, now he was still mad. It had been 10 years since he'd been at meeting. He was still mad. His blood pressure started going up. And he said, I'll tell you what happened. I went in there, and they had a fella up there speaking. And he said he was in an airplane one time and got to wanting to drink so bad he jumped out. And he said, now you know that's a lie, ain't it? I said, well, was the plane in the air? You know, I was trying to give him an out. He said, yeah, it was in the air. I said, do you have a parachute? You know, I was just trying to bring him down a little, but he was having none of it. You know? Now, we could write that off, as we should, that this fella, it just didn't click. The point is that just taking somebody to a meeting doesn't guarantee a darn thing. My God, these things are luck of the draw, man. You get into some and you wonder if you have absolutely gotten a funny farm. You don't necessarily see a solution every time you walk in. Sometimes we agonize the problem to death. So a meeting isn't necessarily it. You know, I'm one who has I'm a guy who, I'm a group man. I'm a guy that's a little leery about the matriculation toward meetings rather than groups. I'm a little suspect of it, to tell you the truth, because what I find is that meetings tend to be a little too superficial for the real issues involved in recovery from alcoholism. Yeah, I like groups. I like the structure and solidity of groups. I like the comprehensive quality of groups. I like the legacy representation in groups. I like the idea that you go through a switch from me thinking to we thinking when it comes to belonging and committing to a group. I think it's important healing. You know, if you think about it, and I don't want to editorialize too much, just enough to get you to think about it. When you think about meetings, what you will normally find is that meetings are pretty much me-centered. You know, they're places where folks tend to have little commitment. They're sort of a nomadic membership. You know, they just sort of go from one place to another. Most meetings have little organization other than just the person presiding and whoever counts the money or steals it. Most have none of the officers that constitute an AA group. Most have no GSR. And are therefore not even connected to the fellowship that they purport to be part of. And so what we wind up with are isolated little gatherings of alcoholics meeting at the level of their own sharing. You'll usually find that they operate at the level of the comfort and convenience of the members. You ever notice how popular lunch meetings are? And happy hour meetings. When I can just sort of casually bop in on my way home.
Yeah, I would submit to you that one of the things that I think is awfully important in recovery is the discipline of participation. I think there's something awfully important, awfully healing about suiting up and showing up. And think about this. Most of you have been around a while. Think about this. How many times you've experienced when you've gone home from work, you're beaten up, you're tired, you're aggravated, you don't want to see another human. You settle down in the chair watching the good news of the evening and or whatever, and you say, boy, this feels good. And then all at once you say, oh, Jesus, meeting night. And then you go through that rationalizing thing. Ah, God, I don't think I'll go. They don't need me. My God, I'm there all the time. And then you say, oh, but there's this new person that I said I would meet. And you suck it up. And you put on your shoes and you boogie off to the group. And what happens? It's the finest meeting you've been to for months. Isn't it? Because it's already made. It can't miss. It can't miss. The minute that I practice the principles of participation, it happens. Nothing magical needs to happen there. It's the business of my doing the things that I need to do. So I'm a fairly unexciting guy about what recovery comes from. I like those fundamental things. I like the things that are reliable and trustworthy and substantive in nature. They're the solutions. Not meetings. I like groups. I like to belong and feel a sense of union with my fellows and with our mission. I don't want to carry too long on that, but I just suggest that you think about, you know, sponsorship has a kind of an enigmatic role in this whole deal. We sometimes make it sound like sponsors need to be a combination of Attila the Hun and Sigmund Freud, and not necessarily so. All a sponsor is a guy who's gone in front of us and cares enough to share with the guy behind him. That's all. We're not remaking human beings. We're not reliquifying and molding human beings. So what we're basically doing is sharing. And if we overemphasize sponsorship, what we wind up doing, well, let me just give you a quick example of that. But I was in the first town I lived in after I got out of jail. I was a real active fellow as I've always been, and that was a kind of a lousy A town, and I was a fairly dominant figure there. I was a hard charging guy. And like a young goat, just, and I was sponsoring everything that had little enough sense to ask me. I had a whole gang of people, and I'll guarantee you I was doing a heck of a job. You know, they if you ask them, I guarantee you, I probably had 10 or 12 guys, and a few gals, because there weren't any women in AA then, and that's an interesting thing in itself. But my basic message to them was, get in the car. You know, we're going somewhere. And I mean all the time. And if you asked them what kind of a sponsor I was, they would have told you that I was an absolutely wonderful sponsor. That I was the finest member of Alcoholics Anonymous that had ever come down the pipe. Guarantee they'd have told you that. Interesting thing happened. I moved away from that town, and every single one got drunk. Everyone. Now, most of them are back sober. I'm re-sponsoring some of them. But the point is, when you let sponsorship become so exaggerated, see, I never did trouble to tell them what the solution was. I never did share with them why I was like I was. I never shared with them where it came from. I just said, get in the car. You do what I say. A little bit of a shortchange. Yeah. But anyway, let me just move on. That to me, this whole business of solution, that it's not an enigmatic, hard-to-find thing. It's a discipline. It's a practice. It's a way of life. And it's not hard work. It's great joy. Once I accept the realities and the parameters in which I must exist, then it becomes a happy and joyous and free way to live. But I have to have the discipline first. I can't just be running loose. What? Oh. This. Push it over here. Okay. Get away from it. Hell. That's a mixed message. I can't. That's I think, you know, the other thing that I just want to talk about a little bit, when you think about this whole business about recovery, it really isn't a drudgery, but it's an interesting way how we deal with this whole business of where sobriety takes us and what recovery is like and how we become happy, joyous, and free. Is this okay now? It isn't? Let me know. He said, turn it down and still hear me. Let me share. Can you hear right now? And I can get louder if I need to. Put the book. God knows, needs the message. Is that working now? Okay. Yeah, thank you very much for letting me know. Isn't that aggravating when you listen to me and you say, well, hell, I'd at least like to know what he says if I disagree. Let me tell you the other thing. That it is interesting how we approach this stuff. But if you look at the chapter, the vision, take a look at the first paragraph, the last paragraph that we read so much, and the last line. What a study in contrast, eh? The first paragraph in vision has to do with the ultimate nitty-gritty reality of alcoholism. Doesn't have to do with nirvana. Has to do with the ultimate reality of what we're about. Then it goes into what the vision's about. Then the last paragraph talks about the vision, but the last line says, as we trudge the road of happy destiny. It doesn't say as we gamble along the road of happy destiny or we traipse the road. It says we trudge the road. There's great joy in this thing. Let me tell you what I really believe is essential to this whole business of finding the joy, of finding the peace and the freedom and the happiness that's rightfully ours as a product of this program. I really believe it has to do with being able to see the vision. Being able to see the vision. I think I've got to be able to see Alcoholics Anonymous in something more than just a little narrow conscript of me and my program. I think I've got to be able to see it bigger. I've got to be able to see it in the context of a group, a district, a nation, a world. Mark just gave me a cue. Several people have asked me about this tithe. First time I've ever worn it at a meeting. My daughter gave me this, and I brought it. I don't want to wear it, but a lot of people asked me about it, and I haven't told anybody. But this is a Save the Children tithe that's designed by a 10-year-old girl named Vanessa. My daughter gave me this. And what it shows, I'll be glad to show it to you after, what it shows is kids joining hands around the world. Well, you know, that principle doesn't apply just to kids, does it? Because part of what the vision of Alcoholics Anonymous is about is seeing ourselves that way. And for some reason, thank God for it, I was one of those who was blessed with the vision. I was blessed with being able to see when folks read to me and I heard folks share, I was able to capture the vision of what Alcoholics Anonymous is about and start to see the energy and the vitality of the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just some little thing of me and my problems and me and my solutions, me and my program, but being able to see it as a movement that could literally provide a chain reaction of love and service around this world. And God, is it ever true? Let me tell you a little thing about visions. Dreams, I guess, are close to visions. And boy, am I ever a guy that's been blessed with dreams come true. You know, when I was in a penitentiary, I had visions of things in my own life. You know, I've had a vision of someday being in decent work that was honest and that I could be proud of. And I am so pleased to tell you that I've found myself in a career that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world, and I've been blessed with rising to the top of my profession. And it's an unbelievable story in itself. I won't even go into it now. I wondered if I would ever have family, and I'm blessed with a 26-year marriage that I think is a direct product. The successful joy of that marriage is a direct product of this. A couple of kids that daughter graduating in 3 weeks from UNC and a son in medical school and starting clinical rounds in June. Amazing. And the dreams come true. And I've had many, God knows. Let me just share a couple with you about what the vision looks like. What the vision looks like if you haven't seen it. I used to read AA Comes of Age when it first came out. And I used to hear people describe the early days in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know the how it shows the pictures and of Akron activities and the New York office and all that and the first coffee pot. I used to mentally picture that. Yeah, gee, that must be nice. And someday I may see that place. In 1985, Alcoholics Anonymous celebrated its 50th anniversary. I was one of the speakers at the 50th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, Founders Day in Akron. Isn't that an ironic thing? You know, with all of the talented, gifted, articulate people that we have in this program, get some old grungy ex-con. How fitting, that we don't look for the rich and powerful and well-connected. We look for the guy just recovered from the disease. Finished that meeting, I went over to Dr. Bob's house. I'm on the board of trustees of that house now, and so very grateful to see it in existence. I went over to the house after the lunch, and I'll tell you, I've never told this before, but I had, without a doubt, one of the mountaintop experiences that I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was there browsing around the house, and somebody asked me if I wanted a sandwich. Now, I'm looking at the house I visualize in the maximum custody penitentiary. I said, yeah, sure, I would. And so I walked into Dr. Bob's kitchen, sat down at his kitchen table with his son and with his daughter. Visions aren't far off things. If anybody had ever tried to tell me that my journey would take me in that direction, you think I would have believed it? That's the vision. It's the vision of knowing that real life is here. Real joy, real participation beyond anything I ever imagined. I'll tell you one other thing about a vision. Back in the early 60s, I was going to the International in Toronto. It was my first one. I was going primarily to see Bill. I just wanted to see him because I thought he was going to leave us. And so I was going, and I was doing a lot of work with that prison in Raleigh. And there was one young fellow there that was doing great in the program. And he was the artist for a publication that we did. He had a sentence of life and 40 years. So I knew he was going to be there a long time. He did too. And we were doing this, and he was writing a center thing like Playboy does. Not exactly like Playboy, but he was writing this centerpiece of how he envisioned the International Conference in Toronto. I still got the book, and he showed a guy with a stick on his back walking in the sign said Toronto, and while we were doing that, I just made a casual remark to him. I said, you know, if you keep doing what you're doing, one of these days, you and I may just go to one of those things together. How do you suppose that sounded? You suppose that made a lot of sense to a guy doing life in 40? Almost sounds cruel, doesn't it, to say that one day we'll go to one of these together. 1985, 20 years later, Alcoholics Anonymous held its biggest meeting in the history in Montreal. Who you reckon he was my honored guest. What a great, great feeling of affirmation and realization of how powerful this thing is. Your vision. In 1990, he spoke at the International in Seattle. Fine fellow. You see, when you talk about the vision, we don't talk about just the vision of attainment, the vision of success, the vision of acclimation. If you look at how the chapter working with others is introduced, what it describes is the powerful effect that you and I have on each other. And then it talks about the joy that comes from watching alcoholics get well, from watching families reunited, from watching this miracle happen. How fortunate you and I are. How fortunate. To be able to see gatherings of us like this in every corner of this world. I'm just so grateful to be a part of it and to be able to invite you in with absolute confidence that if you'll give yourself to this simple program and let it carry you, it'll carry you places you never dared dream. Thanks, folks.